Coming up on Tech News Weekly, we check in on the Black Hat Security Conference, also the controversial ejection of InfoWars by Apple, YouTube, and many others, how Chinese tariffs are threatening the technology industry, and a hands-on with the newly announced Samsung Galaxy Note 9. All that more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 44, recorded Thursday, August 9th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use code TWIT for 20% off. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. How are you, Jason Howell?
I'm doing good. It's good to see you again, Megan Maroney. You were out last week.
I was.
You were missed.
Thank you.
I hope you had a good time.
I did have a good time. I took a little staycation, and it was lovely.
I don't even know what a staycation is.
I know. You always go places.
That's right, because if I stayed home, it would be very relaxing.
True.
That's my experience.
Anyway. All right, this week in Vegas, it's hot enough to fry an egg on a cryptocurrency mining router, which means it must be time for Black Hat and DEF CON. Joining us live from the show is Ian Thompson from The Register. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks very much. And yes, it is hot as all goodness, I will say. Put it that way.
All goodness. I like that. What is the big news from the show so far, from both shows?
Ooh. Well, I mean, DEF CON's just about to kick off. They're just having the early sessions this morning, but I'm still at Black Hat at the moment. Parissa Tabriz, Google's self-styled security princess, pulled off an absolute blinder of a keynote yesterday. Pointing out that it shouldn't all be fun and games. You've got a party as well to keep staff motivated.
Party.
It's just you've got to set severe goals. When they did the four-year program to get us all onto HTTPS, you know, that was 4 years of hitting management goals. But at the same time, you've got to have a little celebration after each one so everyone keeps motivated, which is actually quite a good idea and something the security industry could learn from.
Especially when you've got Google money to blow on everything. Mm-hmm.
Well, that helps, but, you know, some of the stuff they were doing was like buying store-bought cakes and just icing HTTPS onto there. So, I mean, this is not huge amounts of cash that is being thrown around here.
Right.
We've had a couple of themes on the story. Hyper-V is very much in hackers' views at the moment. We've had four or five talks about that. Interesting side thread on the use of addiction and burnout amongst IT professionals, in that IT pros, because they tend to work very long hours, it's very high stressed. If something goes wrong, then they really are up a certain creek without a certain implement. And so they're more like this causes cortisol problems in the brain, which is more likely to lead to heavy drinking and substance abuse. Oof. And it's something the industry, I think, hasn't really taken seriously. But there have been a lot of talks about that over the last couple of days. And then, of course, we've just had the car hacking demo, which Charlie Miller and Chris Vasanek do these every couple of years. And this time they were looking at hacking autonomous cars, which turns out to be both easier and more difficult than you would have thought.
Why? Tell us why. Why is it easier and more difficult?
Well, I mean, on one level, it's easier because they're building these cars from scratch. So they can start building in, more advanced technology. For example, on a standard car, most of the information goes through CANs. Whereas with autonomous cars, then they're putting it through Ethernet. Now, that's both good in that you've got, you know, Ethernet is a well understood protocol, but it's bad in terms of some of the manufacturers are running this without TCP, without TLS. So, in other words, no security whatsoever. So they're working at Cruise, which is General Motors' autonomous car division. And they reckon they've got the software security side of it pretty well understood. Basically ensuring that everything's encrypted, keys are stored safely, and that the cars can't be hacked remotely. The other big advantage from an autonomous car perspective is that most people aren't going to own these cars. They're just going to hire them for short-term hops, which means at the end of the day, the car goes back to the manufacturer's facility, and that makes it much safer from physical attacks. Plus, they all have cameras studded all the way around them, so if anybody does try a physical attack, then their mug is going to appear on the next police website.
And if it's going back to a facility, also from an update standpoint, keeping it updated and secure, there's probably more incentive you know, for the for that facility to keep those updated, as opposed to all our cars that, you know, we don't think twice about that angle, that aspect. If we own them, that just improves the security model all around.
Indeed. I mean, they're actually talking about updating the software in these every sort of day, if at all possible. So I think that's going to be really interesting. Also, I mean, there's the actual physical locking down the physical car, because, you know, there's a lot of things like ODP2 ports on standard cars. Because this is all custom, they can make their own custom physical ports and put sensors in there, so that if someone tries to physically get into the system and attach, say, a new controller, or even just fiddle with the firmware, then they're going to know about it and they can shut that car down and kill it dead.
So you talked about Parisa Tabriz, the head of Google Engineering, who gave the keynote. What about Microsoft? What did you see there?
Oh, Microsoft was fun. They actually had two senior Hyper-V engineers who gave this great presentation on basically saying, please hack us. You know, there's $250,000 up for reward if you manage to get into the Hyper-V kernel and, you know, create a working exploit for it, and we will happily pay you $250,000 for that. And then went into some details about where you should look for attack surfaces, where you shouldn't. You may be wasting your time going directly for the kernel because it's an independent binary. But, you know, if you look at the communications channels, there could well be an opportunity there for you to go out and sort of hack something big. And they've got sort of bug bounties going all the way down to $5,000, all the way up to $250,000. And this is a really big change for Microsoft, because up until 2013, they didn't offer a bug bounty at all. In fact, they actively refused to do it and work with the hacking community. And I do think on this, they've really come, you know, done a full volt face, and they're doing, you know, they're now following industry best practice.
Yeah, well, so in reading your article, you know, it kind of made the point that Hyper-V, as you know, as a target, is very hard, very difficult to find exploits in. And I'm just kind of curious from my perspective. Like, I'm not a hacker. I don't you know, understand how these things differ underneath. But what makes Hyper-V so much more difficult to find exploits that they would feel the need to offer such a high bounty to find them?
Well, it's a standalone kernel. It's not actually built into the rest of the system. And it's been designed from the ground up to keep everything very firmly partitioned. And there's only one sort of really communications channel that you can use to switch between partitions and between virtual machines. They've also, I think, put an awful lot of work into locking down all the possible inputs that are going to be coming through. So I think that's very important in keeping it secure. And plus, I think they've really benefited from, you know, certainly in the last 5 years, they've really made an effort to make their code much more secure by design, rather than just dealing with vulnerabilities as they come up. You head to the root cause and you get that sorted out, and that actually clears an awful lot of problems further all the way down the line.
So blockchain is a word everyone likes to throw around these days. Will it solve all of our or any of our security problems?
I doubt it very much. I mean, the minute you hear blockchain, you immediately think, well, words that I can't say on air. But I mean, there are a few companies who are sort of touting blockchain as the cure-all to everything. But I mean, this is something that Parisa made in a keynote. Don't expect blockchain to save you. It's an interesting technology, but it's in no way a security panacea, which we should think is just going to solve all these issues. I think, to be honest, it's been done to death. One thing I noticed going around the exhibition halls is that there aren't a lot of companies who are putting up big signs, you know, we are blockchain busters and that sort of thing. It's more a sort of, yeah, we'll add it in if necessary. But I do think we're now getting over the hype cycle on blockchain and things are getting back to normal.
No, but didn't you know blockchain's going to disrupt all sorts of industries in about 5 years? And, you know, 20 years from now, it'll be what the internet was 15 years ago. Or at least that's what I'm told.
And I also hear that this year is going to be the year of Linux on the desktop as well. So
just cross your fingers. Well, you mentioned Parisa. One of the things that I kind of took away from your write up about that is that she made the point that the security, the computer security, world that we live in is actually world security. In other words, we're so surrounded by all of this technology that it's no longer an issue of, you know, tightening up security for computers, because in essence, that extends to all facets of our life, all facets of the world. How exactly did she give any kind of guidance or information, insight into how the audience there who would gain from that knowledge could do better at security in the broader sense?
Well, I think this was a theme of both her and Jeff Moss, who founded Black Hat and gave the introductory talks. When he identified there are about 20 companies, basically operating systems manufacturers, browser manufacturers, networking gear manufacturers, who basically control the technology that everyone on the planet uses. And Bruce said something very interesting in terms of we need to make incentives sort of slightly different in that we've now got to insist with these people that they actually do lock down their systems, that they offer security by default. We had the case of one networking manufacturer who, unfortunately, they wouldn't give the name for, but had their systems set, you know, the default settings for their systems were wide open. And that makes no sense. And when they called them on it, they're like, oh, well, the customers didn't really ask for that. It's, like, it's not a matter of the customers asking for it. You've got to do this by default, because otherwise we're all screwed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I prefer security by default in the future rather than blockchain saving anything.
opt into security.
Yes. Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us. Ian Thompson is a reporter at the Register, a frequent Twit guest, an overall great guy who can be found abusing British slang on Twitter at Ian Thompson. Thank you.
Have a good day. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ian. Stay safe in your journeys out there.
Always.
All right. So this week was a notable beacon in how tech companies police the content that's distributed on their networks. Alex Jones, host of the controversial and conspiracy-driven show InfoWars, I'm sure many people would agree with that, was suddenly booted out of Apple's podcasts and iTunes apps. And then soon after, Facebook and YouTube followed suit by removing Jones's content from their networks. In all cases, the companies cited the fact that content on the shows crossed a line that violated their hate speech and harassment policies. Well, joining us to discuss this complicated and politically charged story is Ian Scher from CNET. How's it going, Ian?
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. It's great to get you back. It's like Ian's back-to-back today. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate you coming on. So first of all, because this is a pretty complicated story and there's definitely a heated debate on this from all angles, is this about squashing opposing viewpoints or is it ultimately about taking down legitimately harmful content? This probably depends on who you ask, but
is absolutely about who you ask. I think that is the question that a lot of people have. And look, Mark Zuckerberg himself, when he was on Capitol Hill back in April, said that, look, it's no secret that San Francisco Bay Area has a predominantly liberal point of view. But the big concern here is that Alex Jones in particular has whipped his fans into a fury where they have they've harassed and attacked people who are victims of shootings. You know, the New York Times had a particularly sad story about one of the parents of the Sandy Hook children who died couldn't live near their children's grave anymore. And it's just kind of the what happens in the world of Alex Jones and InfoWars is very sad. So the companies seem to have all kind of come to this conclusion, but on some level, we're waiting until one moved first. And that one who moved first, it's unclear, it might have been Stitcher or Apple, but sometime around Thursday or Sunday, things started happening. And by today now, we're at a lot of the major platforms out there, other than notably Twitter, have banned InfoWars from their services.
So free speech obviously means something. It's more complicated in this day and age. Obviously, Twitter, Apple, they're all privately owned companies. They have their own space. But when we were growing up, we learned about free speech, like you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Like that was the thing that you can't do. I mean, is that what this is, you know, are they equating that to this? I mean, their mobs are causing harm to people.
I mean, it's much easier than this. The companies don't have to follow free speech laws. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Constitution, which we lay out, by the way, on CNET, in case you haven't read the First Amendment recently, does not apply to companies. They can do whatever they want. What was challenging here and what the companies continue to struggle with is seeming like they're being consistent. And this is what it comes down to. What are the rules and how do we follow them? And what's expected of the users who are on there, particularly the ones who walk right up to the line and dangle their foot over it a little bit, but don't always cross it. And that's the challenge. And that is where they open themselves up to criticism. This is something that happened back when, if you remember, Donald Trump, when he would tweet things, particularly threats to other countries or even harassing other women, you know, these kind of controversial tweets they would have, a lot of people would say, hey, wait a minute, these are against Twitter's rules. Why are you allowing this? And eventually Twitter had to come out and say, you know what? Leaders of countries get a free pass and we have a new rule that's just for them. And so that's kind of the challenge here, is that if there are rules against this kind of things, and yeah, Silicon Valley doesn't want to look like it's silencing conservative voices, fine. Then what are the rules and how do we follow them and what's expected of us? And that's where they still, to this day, don't really have very good answers.
Yeah, it really, really feels that way. Apple, like you said, it seemed to have made the move first and the others followed. Twitter, on the other hand, did not act to remove this content. And then we've heard from CEO Jack Dorsey very recently. He kind of put out a statement on this. What do we know about that and kind of their explanation as far as why this is surviving on their service, but it's not surviving on other similar services?
Yeah, it seems as though Jack Dorsey is very good at sticking his foot in his mouth. what he keeps doing is he tries to keep trying to explain where he's coming from. And what happens is that he ends up offending a bunch of people. Most recently, in one of his tweet storms, he said that, you know, it was up to journalists to debunk what Alex Jones says. And it almost sounded like it's your problem, not mine, which also obviously looked terrible. If you want to kind of live on the supportive end of Jack Dorsey, maybe he was trying to be supportive and say, no, journalism helps with this whole situation. But then he went also on Sean Hannity's radio show yesterday and tried to defend himself there. And it just seems as though Twitter has a very hard time actually explaining its position. And it's becoming quite a mess for them because they're an outlier now in the tech industry. They've got pressure from the conservative end of the world who say, look, you know, we don't want you to go down the slippery slope of banning people that you disagree with. But then on the other end of it, people are rushing through everything Alex Jones ever tweeted to see, oh, wait, didn't that violate your policies? Didn't that violate your policies? And so there's no winning in this situation at this point.
I think it's really a tricky situation for all of us, because all of Tuesday, I mean, I follow a lot of tech journalists, and there was a constant stream of people using Twitter to criticize Twitter. Yeah. It was this, I mean, that's where we all are. There are other places to go, but, you know, no one's there. So, I mean, what do you make of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, Twitter has become a central part of the news world. And even though only about, you know, a little over 300 million people use it, it is incredibly influential. I mean, the president of the United States uses it every day. So that is something that there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And I think that's why Twitter gets so much criticism, is that people want it to be better, right? We see it as almost an extension of the media world. And we all, of course, love to criticize the media world every day. I do it myself. And so it's just natural to criticize Twitter as well. But part of the struggle here is that Twitter just has not been good at communicating. And I'm not the only one saying that. Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, says that they are bad at communicating about what they're doing. And so this is where the challenge is. And look, supposedly Jack Dorsey, along with Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook, and possibly Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, are going to be on Capitol Hill in a little under a month trying to talk to Congress. And I guarantee you, we all on this stream are going to be a lot easier to work with than when he's up in front of Congress and he's got congressmen grandstanding against him who barely understand how the internet works.
Yeah, I feel like we've seen that once or twice before very recently.
Yeah.
What exactly does this do in terms of InfoWars itself? Obviously, you know, there's a lot of distribution channels that now have become inaccessible. YouTube's a pretty darn big one to lose access to lose your account on if you're, you know, the InfoWars network. What does this do to their bottom line? They kind of distribute their content independently anyways, and isn't that enough? Like anybody could do that, right?
That is definitely a question that's going to be interesting. You know, I don't know if you saw New York Magazine, which I linked to in one of my CNET articles. They estimate that InfoWars makes something like $12.5 million a year selling vitamin supplements. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling Alex Jones is going to be okay. But deplatforming him, if you want to use that term, is definitely something that's going to impact him. And losing that ability, the real thing is that he loses his ability to expand. He loses his ability to be part of that algorithm that shows people who start down the rabbit hole of what he talks about to go even further with him. And that's going to be what's interesting, is that can he grow anymore or does he end up staying as a niche? And it's no question that in the last 2 years, Alex Jones has gone from being a niche or fringe or whatever word you want to use to being much more mainstream, in part because we have a culture now that is very much more open to conspiracy theories. And Pizzagate's a great example of that. And we also have the President of the United States actually amplifying some of these conspiracies. And so that's a problem, too, that gives Alex Jones much more play than otherwise he would have. Mm-hmm.
So Apple is doing something interesting. They removed the podcasts from Apple Podcasts, but the iOS app is still up there. And right. They defended that decision to BuzzFeed. It's very confusing to me. It seems like they're saying that it doesn't violate any of their policies. But if Alex Jones as a whole is inciting his followers to violence, how does that not go against their policies?
I mean, this is the mealy-mouthed issue that you're going to get from tech industry for quite a while. I think we are getting to a point, it's really interesting, where we are trying to set what the rules are, essentially, right? Because we don't have a constitution for the internet. So one of the first rules was inciting violence, right? We're going to take down ISIS and terrorism and the Myanmar stuff and all of that. Okay, fine. We all agreed on that. This is the next step, right? We're starting to decide that Alex Jones and the kind of stuff that he does is not okay as well. And the question is, how far does this go, right? And I think that the companies themselves don't know. I asked as many of the companies as I could, what specific thing about Alex Jones caused you to shut him down on this week versus last week and all the other years before that? And none of them would give me a specific example because I think they don't have one. I think that they just decided once one or two of them went, okay, we now feel comfortable that we can do this as a group. We don't have to take all the slings and arrows on our own. And that has its own implications and concerns, which does not help this debate, frankly.
Yeah, and anyone coming out and saying, you know, this is censorship, depending on what side of this argument or this story you are on, you know, it should be pointed out that the InfoWars terms of service on their site also have something listed in there that basically says it's not censorship if you violate the rules and your post is deleted. They all have this terminology because they are not a government entity. They can choose what they allow on their network and what they don't. InfoWars does it. These services do it as well. And for whatever reason at this point, they chose that they didn't want InfoWars on their anymore, and it's going to be interesting to kind of see this play out. A little bit of a double standard, though, when people side one way or the other compared to that, right?
It's a really challenging situation, and I do not envy the position that all of these tech people are in. That is part of why they're paid the big bucks, and they choose to have these jobs. But these are critical questions, and it's very hairy. I'm glad we're having these conversations because they need to be had. But it's going to be really fascinating to see the answer. I don't really know how it's all going to play out.
Yeah, I don't think anyone does. Ian Scher from CNET.com, really appreciate you coming on once again to talk with us about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, have a great night.
The White House tells tech companies they're playing the long game in terms of tariffs on gadgets. David McCabe from Axios explains. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. Jason is holding a slide belt right now, and you can take a look at it.
Uh-huh.
This one is emblazoned with the Twit logo. And you would be emboldened if you wore it emblazoned with the Twit logo.
You go, Megan.
Now, your belt isn't something you think about often, except for when you hit the last hole and then the strap is too small and you have to struggle to make it fit. But as Jason's demonstrating, these ratchet belts can fit. Oh, isn't that a lovely sound?
I know. That's satisfying.
It's a sound that echoes through the Twit bathrooms these days.
Yes, it's so true.
It's lovely. Because we're all getting slide belts.
Yes. No, they're great. I love them.
They are. They have this patented technology that I showed you, the ratchet. It's designed to adjust precisely to you. It has 32 adjustment options. It's so much more comfortable than all the other belts I've worn. And belts are back. They kind of went away for women. I don't know if you knew this, but they are back. And they have women's belts. I know every time Leo talks about this, he says, do they have women's belts? I'm like, yes, they have great belts. They have the skinny belts. They have rose gold belts. And it's such an improvement to the traditional belt because you can easily remove the buckle and mix and match with all the colors and other straps for ultimate customization and versatility. Slide Belts offers a wide selection of straps from full grain and top grain leathers to high quality canvas an animal-friendly vegan. So you don't have to kill. I know Josh just gave a little whoop back there. You can get it without killing a cow. It's awesome. Slide belts can be worn casually around the house and at the office or out for date night. They make women's belts, as I said. If you have exhausted ideas for gifts for people, try a slide belt. They are just unique enough to get you back in the good graces of anyone you've failed in the past by getting them some lame gift. It's also great to travel with. They're easy to take off and on while going through security. And if you're not convinced, slide belts will offer a one-year warranty, free exchanges, and no-hassle returns. I want to show you off, if you haven't seen this, this is the awesome slide belt that comes with all these different, it's the survival belt.
The slide belt will save your life.
It really will. Leo also has said in the past, these make great gifts for groomsmen. I think they
would
also
make
gifts for bridesmaids, because sometimes you need a knife. Now, if you are ready for a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit, slidebelts.com/twit. And then when you get there and you're at checkout, add twit to receive 20% off your order. Add that in the little place where it tells you to add it, so that way they know that you heard about them from us. Don't forget to use the code twit. And that way you will get 20% off your order. And we thank Slide Belts for their support. Last month, we heard that Donald Trump reportedly assured Tim Cook that iPhones would not be part of the upcoming trade tariffs. But then we heard that Apple's Apple Watch won't be spared. The news on our trade wars with China changes so often that we thought we would bring in Axios tech reporter David McCabe to help. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you for having me back.
So you had a scoop this week about a White House meeting for tech execs last week. What can you tell us about the meeting?
So last Thursday in the Indian Tree Room of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building right next to the White House, tech groups convened with a whole group of White House officials. And what they wanted to talk about was tariffs. The White House officials essentially tried to reassure them that, no, your worst fears aren't going to come true. This will ultimately be good for your industry. And of course, the tech executives essentially said, we want to know a little bit more about what you think the plan is here.
So I know you didn't write about who was there, which tech companies were there, but who did they get to speak to, these anonymous tech companies?
Yeah, so right, it was a selection on the tech side of companies and major trade groups, top players in the space. And they spoke to White House officials from a number of different departments and divisions, including the U.S. Trade Representative, the Department of the Treasury, the Commerce Department, which meant they were getting a sort of broad picture of the White House's strategy on tech. This was organized by the Office of Public Liaison that's responsible for sort of doing public outreach. But again, the conversation, my sources tell me, kept going back to trade.
Okay, so it goes back to trade. Obviously, tech in the crosshairs and kind of top concern here. What kind of product categories are kind of involved? Obviously, it wouldn't be a broad swath. Are there any particular product categories that would feel the hit potentially more than others?
So, you know, they've said that they are trying to, or they've indicated that they're trying to kind of cut out the consumer products directly. But it's the component parts. It's, I think, LED screens or LEDs are one aspect of the tariffs potentially in play. So it's these component parts and potentially sensors that could come into play here. So it's the component parts, and then down the supply chain, the thought is it might kind of hit the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So in your piece, you say that that the White House was sort of assuring them, saying, you know, assuring these companies, like, we're playing the long game. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And, you know, just this is good for you. What is it? I mean, it has something to do with intellectual property, right? They're claiming that the companies will have better control of their intellectual properties after this trade war magically ends.
Essentially. So, I mean, we all know that tech has a number of market access concerns when it comes to China. One of the big ones is this idea of forced intellectual property transfer, that you have to sort of give up some of your IP if you want in on China. And what the White House's message seemed to be, according to my sources, was this will help us in those conversations. It will help kind of push China to change on some of these issues. I think some in tech might be receptive to that. Others might not be sold.
Are there examples here where it seems like the White House has a good feeling that placing tariffs on something like semiconductors is, as one example, placing tariffs on that particular product category, they might feel like it's going to hurt in the short run, but in the long run, it's going to be good, when in reality, American chip makers are saying, no, actually, this is a really big deal in the short term, and are panicking as a result of that. What was your kind of thoughts there?
You know, I think that obviously certain segments of the industry are harder hit by some of this than others. I think hardware is an obvious segment to look at on this. I think that more broadly, you know, this is still really playing out. Obviously, there was an announcement shortly after our story came out that there was likely to be more tariffs down the road. These were expected, but they were talking about what they might apply to and how high the tariffs might go. So this continues on. I think China has also continued in sort of its bellicose rhetoric, particularly towards Apple recently. So this is still sort of an ongoing fight. I don't think we're yet in the results stage where we can say, well, here was the outcome. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the feeling that these tech companies are worried? I mean, even a company like Apple that, you know, has a $3 trillion market cap, like, are they worried about these tariffs?
You know, there's a lot going on in Washington for tech right now, obviously, from privacy to some of the concerns about disinformation. I mean, just this week, right, Apple had to deal with the Alex Jones story, despite being sort of spared from some earlier disinformation or hate speech or conspiracy theory questions. You know, I think tariffs, though, are sort of a major, major issue for them and for their lobbyists. It's something that some of the big trade groups, which often sort of are the proxy for these companies, right, have been pushing on very quietly or quietly and then with more heft, but there's just so much going on that it doesn't necessarily become a front page issue.
I want to switch gears for a second. We just spoke about the Alex Jones, which you brought up, and and Jack Dorsey kind of going on this weird media tour. And what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it's just, to me, it's very ironic that all these tech journalists are using Twitter to complain about Twitter.
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm in a great place to say whether or not what my peers and colleagues are doing is ironic or not. I do think, though, it's very clear that Twitter has decided that it's time to put Jack in front of the public. We saw him on Hannity this week. That obviously drew some backlash. We reported last night that it's likely that he's going to go on CNN and NBC next week. So they're clearly trying to put him out in front of people to defend and become the face of this decision to keep Alex Jones on the platform, which essentially has made him the last man standing among the major platforms.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. David McCabe is a technology reporter at Axios, and he is D. McCabe on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, David. We'll talk to you soon. Samsung held its annual Unpacked event this morning. Florence Ion and I were on set doing live coverage, so we had the chance to analyze the announcements from afar. But Rich DeMuro from KTLA and Rich on Tech was at the event in New York, so he saw things live and in person and even got some hands-on time with the Note 9. Might even have it in his hands right now. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yes, I do have it in my hands. This is the lilac purple or lilac lavender, I think. I got to get the name right on this thing.
Yeah, it's something like that. They always have kind of like the purple hue model, so to speak, every year, at least the last 3 years now. So you've got it in your hands. So like you're way ahead of everybody just using it. That's a nice looking phone.
Well, they did things a little bit. Oh, I just got the notification to be on the show right now. they did things just a little bit different this year. They actually gave out review units at the event. So I thought that was pretty cool because a lot of times they send you your review unit like the day after the event. So it's like, why spend all that money and time and effort? Anyway, but this is it. So I've been checking it out, setting it up, kind of figuring it out. It's very similar to what you have on the S9 Plus. But I think they did fix where the fingerprint reader is. I think the addition of the dual aperture on the camera is nice. And the Bluetooth on the stylus, I'm not sure how useful that's going to be, but I can see how it could be useful if you're looking for that sort of power machine here, like if you do presentations off this thing.
Yeah,
that remote control stylus, I saw you show it off in your YouTube video. It is pretty cool, but yeah, how would you use it? And it's the battery life of the stylus is not very long as well, right?
Yeah, the battery life is just a half an hour outside of the phone. So, of course, it still works. It still works to do all the things you can do on the phone, right? So, even if the battery's dead, it's still going to tap the photos and all that stuff, or, you know, go around on the screen, but it's just not going to use the remote control part. That's going to stop working. But the good news is it only takes 40 seconds to charge this thing. So it's kind of like an electric toothbrush. There's a little super capacitor on here. So you pop it in here, and there's no actual indication that I can see of how much it's charged. Maybe it's in there in the settings somewhere, but you pop it in there, 40 seconds later, it's charged up. I made the joke that if you have a presentation that's lasting longer than 30 minutes, you know, for work, you should probably trim it down anyway. So hopefully 30 minutes will be enough to get people through.
Just make sure you pull out that S Pen right at the beginning of your talk and no earlier. Otherwise, you'll be wondering what's going on. I thought that the strategy of putting Bluetooth LE into the S Pen, and then also the strategy of moving DeX from this clunky like desktop dock sort of thing into a little HDMI dongle is kind of a smart strategy on Samsung's part, in the sense that they're taking these things that maybe people might be less inclined to use for whatever reason. Like, I'm not an artist, so why would I use the S Pen? Or it's not part of my everyday routine. But giving another reason to, or making it easier to get into there, especially with the HDMI dongle with the DeX technology, maybe that's enough to like move people into more usability, and then they understand why those things are useful and use them more. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the whole, I think that's kind of the bottom line of the Note in general, is that you kind of discover what you can do with just a phone, right? So, I mean, I think it started with like a notepad. It's like, oh, I don't need to carry a notepad around because I can actually use the stylus to take notes on the screen. That's kind of cool. I don't need to carry a tablet around because I can actually watch YouTube and videos on this screen without worrying about having a giant tablet with me. So now I can do that. And I agree, when it comes to sort of the upper end features like the DeX stuff, I don't know if I'd try it, but maybe I would now, because all I need is that dongle. Now, they haven't said how much that dongle is, right? Mm-hmm. Is it like $50 or is it more?
I didn't see a price on the dongle, actually. I would be really surprised if it was more than 50, but
yeah, they did say in a briefing that you can use any third party dongle, like an HDMI kind of thing that's certified. So it's not like a secret sauce that Samsung has. So, but they also did not offer up the price in the meeting that I was in, at least when we were talking about this stuff. Yeah. But I think you're onto something, Jason. I think that the people that are getting this phone, they want to get the most out of it. So I agree. Having those extra features are kind of cool. You're like, oh, maybe I'll set my phone up on a tripod and use the little stylus as a remote control and take more family pictures. You know, I like to do that whenever we have a family gathering. I always set up the phone on the tripod and kind of take like a timed picture, you know, of the group. Now I just use this.
Yep.
You can use your Apple Watch.
That is true. You can use the Apple Watch, and I agree, but that's a how much is that accessory? Let me think. Yeah. $300+. So, I mean, I get it. This is not cheap either. You know, the price on this thing, $1,000 for the 128 gigabyte model, and then $1,250 for that 512. But again, you are getting a lot of features built into this thing. I don't think you'd need a tablet if you have this device.
So the reason why I bring up the Apple Watch is I know you just wrote a book about iPhones. Jason says you're an Android guy. I know that you do Rich on Tech, and it's you, and so you cover everything. But I just need to know, which phone do you reach for when it's just you and the phone and the TV cameras are off?
I'll be honest. I always carry around two phones, and I hate this question because everyone wants to nail down which phone I use. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest. I love the iPhone for content creation and also the ecosystem. And when you talk about having the Apple Watch on with the iPhone, it's like a match made in heaven. And plus the iMessages coming to your computer, AirDrop for all these little things I make, it's amazing. But when it comes to kind of customization and doing things the way I want to do them, that's when I reach for my Android. And it, you know, the fact that you can do exactly what you want on your Android, you know, you can download 15 different launchers and have your phone work in a different way, to me is really interesting. But I also respect the fact that Apple has a lot of things that work really well on their phone. And I find myself more frustrated when I'm using my Android than I am when I'm using my iPhone, which is kind of interesting.
All right, so Apple Watch versus what we now know is the Galaxy Watch. Did you did you have a chance to play around or see the Galaxy Watch up close? And is it running Android or is it running Tizen? That's the big question I have.
The one I saw seemed to be running Tizen because it looked identical to the Galaxy. I think it was the Gear Sport or something like that Gear I tested S3, earlier in the year. I mean, I couldn't even see a difference. I think, I mean, number one, the Apple Watch is the best wearable in the world right now. So I'd say the number two is probably the Fitbit, the Versa. I think that's really nice. But it just, when you think about what the Apple Watch does compared to the Fitbit and these other things, it just works so seamlessly with the iPhone that it's really tough to beat that. I also think the integration of companies, like at my gym, when I get near my gym, my little wallet pass pops up on the Apple Watch. And that's just something that's really delightful. You know, it's like I didn't expect that. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Instead of having to reach for my phone to get my barcode, it just shows up right in my Apple Watch. It's like little integrations like that that I haven't really seen on a big level or easy from the other guys. I mean, I know Versa has other integrations. I'll be honest, I never even set them up, never even set up the Starbucks card on there because it just seemed like, okay, am I really going to use this? I don't know.
Speaking of little magical things, you also showed off the camera in the Note. Is it the Note 9 that we're talking about?
Yeah. There's been nine of them at this point.
Is it the not iPhone that we're talking about, right? That's the not iPhone? Okay, got it.
These Android conversations are tough for you. I know.
I know. It's true. When you take a picture of food, like a little icon of food comes up, or when you take a picture of a person, a plant, so it lets you take pictures better of certain items. Of course, when you showed this off, it was their little demo table with the plant and the food that they had put out there. But do you think this is something that will delight people?
I'm trying it right now. My hotel room actually has a little plant right here, and no, it's not working. You know, it's one of these things. I think that anything that gives the average user an edge with their pictures is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You guys know, you probably see people out and about taking pictures with their smartphone. It's literally they're in a 100% dark restaurant and they're taking a picture of the group of the people at the table. And it's like, I know that that picture, unless they're using a Pixel 2 XL, is going to be terrible, right? It's not going to look good at all. So if this device can recognize the scene that you're taking a picture of and tweak those settings that most pros might know how to do and make those pictures look a little bit better, I'm all for it. Like I said, I've only had this phone in my hand for an hour or two right now. I haven't really tested out that feature yet. I'm going to see just what the difference is. But I think that, you know, with the 20 scenes they mentioned, it's everything from like waterfalls to, you know, backlit scenes to a skyscraper scene, a landscape scene, plants, food, you know, all these little things that they've kind of built in. I think we'll see if it's just hokey and kind of like doesn't really help or if it really does help these pictures. So I don't know. I think that the camera on the Pixel 2 XL to me is the best camera out there. I think that the Samsung camera is really nice, but essentially you're getting the camera that is on the S9 Plus for the most part, except for the addition of these new kind of scenes.
Yeah, well, and that AI that's running underneath, that can go a long way, right? Like a large reason why the Pixel 2 camera is so successful is because of, you know, some of the AI stuff that Google's done behind the scenes. Samsung's obviously doing it here with recognizing scenes and making those dynamic adjustments. Also, when you take a picture, it analyzes immediately and lets you know, oh, someone was blinking in that picture. You should take it again, you know? So little things like that I think would delight someone when they experience that for the first time. They're like, oh, the phone saved me.
And I agree. I mean, especially with the blinking thing. I mean, how many times, almost every single time I take a picture of me and someone else, what do? You look at the picture to see if it came out okay.
Yeah.
So if your phone can give you that heads up, you'll start to rely on that and not look at the review picture every single time. So I think that is smart. And again, here's the thing, and I think this was really interesting. DJ Ko on stage, that's the guy that's like the Samsung big guy in charge of mobile. He made a little quip at the end, which he said, every year we push these phones and we try to make them better. And he actually said, and I don't know if you guys caught this, mm-hmm. but he was like, and it is tough to actually make these things better every year because people are expecting these amazing advancements. And we've gotten to a place where these phones are pretty darn good. So it is tough to make them exponentially better every single year.
Absolutely. And then finally, we can't round this out without at least talking about the Samsung Bixby-powered smart speaker, the Galaxy Home. Not available yet. You can't actually buy it or anything, but they showed it off. And they demonstrated it by doing their, like, musical intro where they have the nice swooshy graphics playing on the gigantic screen. The music in the hall was generated by, I think it was 160 Galaxy Homes throughout the area. How did that sound in real life? Like, it's really hard to gather that on the live stream. It just sounded like music.
Yeah, it actually sounded pretty good. And I caught it about a quarter of the way through. I said, you know what? I guarantee it. This is being generated off those little speakers, because the speakers kind of came out silently from the sides of the stage. And you kind of noticed them there. So they're all sitting there. And then I was listening to the music and I said, I guarantee this is being generated. It was great. It did sound good. I'm not an audiophile, so I can't say how great this thing is. I'm sure it's pretty good. I mean, they own AKG. I think Samsung knows a lot about speakers and audio, so I'm sure that this thing is going to be a great sounding speaker. After that, we have no details. Right. When it's going to be out, how much this thing is going to cost. I think Bixby is probably the biggest downside of this, because nobody sold on Bixby. Why would you want Bixby to power your home speaker? I don't really understand that. So I think that if they would have said it would have Bixby and Google Assistant, they would probably have a lot more interest in this device. But if they're relying on Bixby and sound to sell this thing, they got to think again on that.
Yeah.
But the SmartThings Hub is very popular, too, and runs a lot of things. So, I mean, that it contains the SmartThings Hub, right?
I believe that they said that it powers, integrates with SmartThings, yeah.
And that is a popular platform, so that's good. But to me, I don't know, I'm kind of a Google Home guy, so I don't know if I'd take a chance on the Bixby speaker.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the Amazon Echo, which, you know, had nothing when it started, but it was automatically pretty good. But I guess I haven't tried the Bixby, but everyone complains about
it. Well, yeah, and Bixby in general, it like my impression of it, using it over the past like year and a half, and definitely not on a daily basis, is that when it came out at first, it was really more designed to be about device control, like device control with your voice. Now Samsung seems to be expanding it out and saying, hey, we're a voice assistant just like the other ones out there. We do all sorts of things, so much so that we can, you know, have a voice assistant in your home with a smart speaker, and it can manage all of these things. And I think the jury's kind of still out on, like you said, Rich, like whether people actually want that, if they're already kind of bought into an ecosystem. But Samsung loves to think, really enjoys thinking that people want to live their entire life within the Samsung ecosystem. I'm sure there are some people that do. I'm no doubt there are people that buy into that. I don't know to what degree, and I don't know that I know anyone that does.
Well, and don't forget, Samsung plays on a very global field.
Yeah,
so you have Asia, which, you know, you go there and you talk about washing machines and you talk about refrigerators and you talk about these speakers. And yeah, it's not, you know, we're very Apple-centric here in the U.S. and we think Apple, we think Amazon. You have to think there's a whole nother part of the world out there. And so Samsung is very cognizant of that. And in fact, my photographer today, after we were kind of coming back to the hotel, was saying, you know, I really think it's interesting how Samsung has control over your phone, your watch, your speaker, your washing machine, and, you know, those other smart home devices that they mentioned. So there is something there. And I don't think that they're unsuccessful. And I'll be honest, the times that I have used Bixby, I've actually been very impressed with what it can do. It kind of has that deeper level of control of your device. And I think that's interesting. The problem is, when you buy into one of these assistants, you're in. So whether it's Siri, whether it's Google, whether it's Alexa, it's really tough to kind of move in between these various assistants, because you kind of have to get used to them and know what they do and know what they don't do. And you can't really use two of them at the same time, in my opinion.
No.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on what they know about you already. Like, Amazon knows what you buy, if you know, it knows what you watch and what you listen to, and, you know, the Siri knows, you know, has all the information on your phone. And you know, Google knows everything.
Everything. Knows all of the above. But that's a very good point, because something like Cortana, as good as it might be, you know, I don't really have my information stored there. So I don't really know. I don't even want to jump into that, because I'm like, well, I don't, you know, how would I use that? So I do. That's an interesting point, Megan. I think it's part of the reason why these companies are increasingly siloing us into everything that they do. Because it does, it all comes together when you think about these personal assistants. I think Google has done a good job of kind of, you know, like on the Android P, I don't know if you noticed this, Jason, but you can now set Spotify music as like your alarm on the Pixel, which I thought was pretty interesting. So, I mean, I think they're doing a good job of opening these things up as they can. It's tough to do it all. It's tough to integrate all that stuff.
Absolutely. So Rich DeMuro, richontech.tv, is that where your review is going to be, or where can people find it when you're ready to post about this?
Right now, it's all just sort of hands-on, richontech.tv. Hopefully, in the next couple weeks, I'll have a full review, kind of, you know, give this thing a deep dive and take a look at it. But I've got my initial impressions on my website right now, and of course, tomorrow on KTLA Morning News. And the book, you know, I did write a book about the iPhone, 101 Handy Tech Tips for the iPhone. And so that's why I've been using my iPhone for probably the last six months or so nonstop, because I did find a lot of interesting things that even I didn't know about that thing.
That's awesome. Right on. And I should mention that Rich is going to be here in studio next month while Leo and Lisa are away for a couple of weeks helping out on some of the shows. So we'll be doing more shows with you. So we're looking forward to that, Rich.
Can't wait. Looking forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Rich. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to go through all his tweets and see which are tweeted from an iPhone and which are tweeted from an Android.
Oh, don't do that.
He's still here.
You know, can I tell a quick story? Apple actually did that to me one time. Oh, I shouldn't even be telling this story. I'm probably going to be banned from the event.
Yes, you should.
But they actually said to me, they go, "We can't believe you tweeted that compliment about the iPhone from an Android." And I was like, "Will you look at that? Oh my gosh. That's next level." This happened many years ago, so the person is probably not there anymore. But
I'm
still,
sure.
I couldn't believe that was next level. But Megan, you are next level.
I am next level. I am looking forward to co-hosting the screensavers with you, though, when you're here, and I will have all that data with me.
Yes, you'll have the percentage breakdown. Okay, great. Oh no.
Yeah, look forward to that. Now we've got lots to look forward to. Thanks again, Rich. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.
A new study published this week in the journal PLOS found that humans are less likely to turn off a robot if that robot pathetically begs for its life.
Ooh.
That's right. When our robot overlords come for us, apparently we'll do whatever they say as long as they seem desperate enough. Now, this was a rather small test. 85 volunteers were asked to complete tasks with an interactive humanoid robot. When the researchers told the participants that they could turn off the robot, some of the robots said, "No, please do not switch me off. I am scared that it will not brighten up again."
Oh, my goodness. It's so depressing.
You would do it, Jason.
I would have a hard time turning that off. Yeah.
So as a result, a sizable percentage of participants took longer to turn off the robot. Some refused to turn the robot off at all. This number also varied according to how humanoid the humanoid robot was.
Did it have eyes or eyebrows or, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're ending this show as we end so many of our shows when we're talking about robots. We're doomed.
Yeah. Oh boy, I don't know how to, I mean, and you know, we end up in a story that's so easily refers to an episode from Black Mirror, which we talk about probably far too much on this show, or at least I know I do.
Yeah, my reference would be The Good Place, which if you haven't seen, you should definitely watch.
That.
And there is a robot being turned off desperately.
Oh.
I don't want to give any spoilers, but it's a good show.
Yeah, just the idea that inside the technology, like as AI and you know, as artificial intelligence builds out and as robots become more, you know, artificially self-aware and more humanistic in the way that they interact with us, then to a certain degree, there's a really fuzzy line between something living inside of there that has, you know, true human emotion versus something that is like programmed to have it anyways. And we as humans like might have a hard time deciphering the difference between the two. And it's going to be kind of a challenge. I would probably ultimately turn it off, but I would think twice. I'd be in the category of took longer than normal to turn it off. And then at some point I'd be like, it's just a computer.
Right. You'd slap that thing off the side of the
head. I would not. Robots do not listen to Megan. I would not slap you. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday, 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
I am a robot. Subscribe to our show, please, or it will not brighten up again.
Oh, no. You better do it.
Twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about how much you also enjoy The Good Place, I'm at Megan Maroney.
I'm going to have to put that on my watch list. Mm-hmm. I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Josh, Burke, Jammer B, Colleen, everybody who helps us do the show each and every week. And thanks to you for checking it out. We'll see you next time on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.